Okay, we are talking today about uncapping the house. You are an ordinary citizen. You feel like this is an important issue. Are you aware of my positions on this at all? Or have you heard me talk about this at all?
I am not aware of your position on this.
Okay.
I feel like from what I've been told, you're open to the idea.
Gotcha. So I believe in the system, the structure. So I like the concept of like the Senate. I think that I'm okay with the concept of like the filibuster. When I say okay with the Senate, I mean like 2 votes per state. I think I'm kind of sort of maybe okay with the Electoral College. A lot of these things I can be kind of moved on. But with regards to the House of Representatives, I'll let you sell me on the idea. And then I'll give you some of the most common pushback that I hear or pushback that I might have on it. And then we can go from there. Yeah, go for it.
Sounds good. You want me to sell you right now?
Yeah, go for it. Sell it to me right now. Yeah.
So, I mean, think about it this way. You've got a business, right? We were just talking about business. I own a small business. You scale your business. Now you grow, okay? Your customer base triples over the course of, let's say, 10 years. Uh-huh. Are you going to hire more people to take care of those customers, customer service representatives, if you will? Or are you going to make the people that you already had there take care of them? Because it's essentially what we're looking at. We had a population of about 100 million people in 1929 when the house was capped. Uh-huh. Since then, the population has tripled. But the representatives, the people that are supposed to interact with us, to inform us, to listen to us, to make decisions based on our, you know, what we want, that's remained the same at 435. The federal government and the executive branch has grown substantially since that period of time because things still need to get done. Government still has a purpose in society, yet it is the people's ability to check that government and keep it balanced that really matters. And right now, we can't do that. The people in Congress are overworked. They don't even understand. They're so deep underwater, they can't see what the problem is. And the people outside of Congress can't get them to listen to us. You can try to get a meeting with them. It took me almost 2 years to get a meeting with my representative. The representative actually changed from one, not from a different party, but from one person to another person because Wexton retired in this period of time. I had to drive to DC regularly once or twice a week to request a meeting before I was finally granted a meeting to sit down and talk about something that's baked into the Constitution, representative government, growing the house with the population, which we did for the first 100+ years of our existence until we wrote this bill in 1929 that limited it.
Uh-huh. Okay, actually, I totally lied. I have no idea why somebody would be opposed to uncapping the House of Representatives besides like horrible partisan reasons. I'm curious, I guess, in your kind of adventures in this, who do you find from the left or the right? Who usually gives you more pushback against this? And then when it's the right, why do they usually push back against it? Sorry, is it maybe both sides do, I guess. Yeah.
I don't get a lot of pushback. I get a lot of apathy. Uh-huh. People just don't believe things can get better. The only pushback I really get sometimes is people will say, well, they're corrupt, right? And when they say that, they actually mean their side of the other side of the aisle. They're not actually talking about everybody. Uh-huh. They say they're corrupt, they're bad. Why would we want more of them? And I'm like, well, it's more of them is more of you, right? Like you're giving yourself more power. You're giving yourself accountability over those people. You're saying that you can't hold these people accountable right now, and I'm trying to give you a method on how to do it. It's apathy. People just don't feel like things can change. They feel so, I don't know, upset or distrustful of the current system. They've never really lived in the system the way that it was kind of designed. I mean, we bear the fruits of that system. You know, our life is comfortable. We are safe because of the system that we live in, but we've never actually lived in the system the way it was supposed to be designed. So they don't really have a clue. You know, we all have our experiences and our knowledge from what we read, but until you actually like live it and feel it, do you really understand it?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you 1,000%. I feel like a big issue right now that's probably been plaguing us, especially for the past decade, if not longer, I'll try to keep this a little bit apolitical or nonpartisan at least, is I feel like there's been a general trend that's pushed a lot on social media of this very cynical, nihilistic view of government. Or not nihilistic, but very cynical view of government. So it's always corrupt. It's always rigged. There's always lobbyists. It's always terrible. And therefore, they never have our interests at heart. They're always trying to screw us over. And I feel like when everybody comes at it from that perspective, it's very hard to try to suggest any changes because people are just like, well, you know what? So instead of 435 rigged congressmen, now we're going to have 900 rigged congressmen. And starting from there is very difficult. And then the second issue is because we're so hyper partisan today, I don't know if people are aware of like what representatives are supposed to be. Like it, like maybe, well, like what they actually are, unfortunately, right now is it feels like it's just like a party vote, basically. And then some people think that they're maybe supposed to be kind of like for your state. But like what you said, that's not really true. A representative is supposed to represent the people in the district that they live in. And the reason why we have districts is because even in Florida, I live down in Miami Beach. My interest as a citizen of Miami Beach might be way different than somebody who lives up in Ocala or who lives over in Tampa or who lives way up in Jacksonville. And representatives are supposed to represent those interests instead of just strict party line votes. I feel like overcoming those two things, like the misunderstanding of representatives, what they do in government, and the kind of that cynicism is a big part of getting people to say, like, we should probably just have more representatives, like you said, to accurately represent the people in the United States who are supposed to be represented by their representatives.
Yeah. I tell people all the time, representation, right? Your representatives, they have like three main jobs or three main responsibilities. It's communication, right? Listen to inform us. It's responsible, or it's power, right? By going to Washington and speaking for us, they make decisions with power. And then it's responsibility. They have a responsibility to us and to the country at large. Because I think this is where sometimes it gets a little skewed because, you know, you mentioned like, well, it's not necessarily a state. It's the people in the district, but it's also the whole country. You're part of a larger body. You have to make decisions based on, you know, everything that's going on in the world to keep, you know, us safe and productive and moving forward. And I think of it like, you know, democracy is great, right? But like democracy run amok is not necessarily great. Like I don't want to vote on everything that takes place because I don't know everything and I'm never going to know everything. But I do want somebody who is working on those things, that's educated in those things, that can inform me about why they voted the way that they voted and why we should do these things to be in that position and speak for me. I want that. And I want to be able to get a meeting with that person and have an honest conversation to get an idea if they're if they can be trusted, if they are putting in the work, the diligence to read and study on the issues that need to be done. You know, like those type of things are really important. And I think what you said is dead on, is like we don't see representatives the way that they are. They're on TV doing like news hits. Like they're like a micro celebrity at this point. And here's the thing. If you don't like that, then increase the number of them, because then they won't be able to become a celebrity as easily, right? Because there'll be so many more of them, they'll be diluted. Their individual power, their celebrity goes down when you increase the house of the size of the house, and your power as a voter goes up.
Mm-hmm. And theoretically, hopefully, even on those lines, you know, like if you feel like lobbyists have too much power over the people in Congress, well, imagine if they had to lobby for, you know, 1,000 members of Congress instead of just 435. Somebody posted a question in chat and he said, how would party unity be affected when there's many more members to corral? Would it become harder to build coalitions to get things done? I think the answer to that is kind of like yes, but in some ways it should be. Like you want your representative advocating for not just the party's interest, not just like your interest as a member of the party across the country, but like you said, like as a member of your specific district that might have needs that are different from the party, the country, or even other people in your state who are of the same political party. But I think we've like totally lost that part of the conversation politically in the United States. So it doesn't surprise me when you say, unfortunately, that voters are super apathetic about, you know, uncapping the house.
Yeah. So there's two books that really touch on what you just talked about there. When it talks about like coalition government, right? Cause that's what we're kind of like, a coalition government. It's Philip Wallach's Why Congress and Lee Drutman's Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop. And in Philip Wallach's book, he talks about how successful the Civil Rights Acts were, or how they were successful in getting passed. And basically, we just let everybody speak. We let everybody have their say. We voted on it and we had the votes and we moved the country forward. And then in the two-party doom loop, Lee talks about how back then when the representation ratio was closer to like 1 in 400,000 compared to 1 in 800,000 like it is today, we actually had a secret four-party system, right? Because there were liberal Republicans in the Northeast and conservative Democrats in the South. Right. And these two groups would swing back and forth between the two major parties to pass legislation to get things done. For example, you know, the Civil Rights Act, the conservative Democrats did not vote for that, but the liberal Republicans did. Right. And what it is you got to think is like, we've all been in a group scenario with people that think differently than us. And there's always things that will bring the majority of good people together, right? If you have a large enough group, that will happen. If you have too large of a group, you might get so much arguing you never get to vote on anything. But if you have the right size, it'll work. Now, if you have too small of a group, the more passionate people who might be on the wrong end of things might be able to sway people not to vote. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we are. Madison describes this in the Federalist Papers is like, you have to raise the number of the House to avoid against the cabal of a few and also avoid the confusion of the multitude, right? So, and I think like we're way closer to the cabal of a few than we are to the confusion of the multitude right now.
Sure.
We'll have to create new party structures and committees and stuff in the House to make things work. But those are solvable problems, mm-hmm. right? Like this is something that's really important. It's about representation for me, you, or any other American citizen that wants a representative government.
Yeah. Do you think, I guess I'm kind of curious on these lines, on a side issue, do you have strong opinions about gerrymandering? Before we get into the, like, you know, how would you pass this type of thing or what would you push on? I'm kind of curious, do you think that like how districts are apportioned or how gerrymandering is done, is this like a part of your argument for how you consider this or is it just like a totally separate topic? Yeah.
So if you increase the size of the House, you're going to limit the incentive for gerrymandering, right? Because now you have more House districts. It's going to be harder. You're playing a numbers game, right? And mm-hmm. you're trying to get more people on your side in Congress than the other side so you can control the legislative body.
Yeah.
So simply expanding that makes it more difficult. Shrinking the districts also makes it more difficult to know if your gerrymandering is going to be successful because people move so frequently. If you shrink your district too small and there's a big population shift, you might have actually made things worse for yourself than better. And these are things that, because ultimately gerrymandering is fighting over power. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what it is. And that is never going away. You can pass a gerrymandering ban. You can do whatever legislation you want to do, but you're never going to get people not to fight over power. It's just what happens in human civilization.
Yeah.
So like increasing the House limits the incentive for fighting over power. It moves that fight, if you will, into a debate in Congress, which is ultimately what it's supposed to be.
Sure. I guess I'm kind of imagining, and I haven't thought about this before at all, but I'm imagining like a state with two districts. You have a lot of flexibility for drawing these districts contiguously to gerrymander away one side. But if that same state has like 100 districts, like you said, like it becomes a much more difficult project. Your districts either become very weird and stringy, or like you said, they could be highly vulnerable because of, you know, just like a difference in people moving, or maybe a really bad fire actually drives enough people out of a district or something, you know, like in California to change how the balance of power goes. Are there other issues besides gerrymandering that are peripheral to this uncapping the House thing that you think are related to it? Like, does this influence your views on the Electoral College at all? Or yeah, go ahead.
It would affect the Electoral College, but I want to point to campaign finance, mm-hmm. right? Like right now it costs nearly $3 million to win a House race. And part of that is just, it takes so much money to reach all the people in the district, mm-hmm. right? It's all media dollars, advertising, you know, people on the ground knocking doors and stuff like that. Stuff's expensive. Shrinking the districts limits that. I can't remember which book it is, but I read it in, I think it was Acts of Congress. You know, a House representative actually leaves their job when they're working on the Hill to go across the street to another building to make fundraising calls in the middle of the day, mm-hmm. right? That's how important raising money is for their job. Again, this is all about representing people and being able to like communicate with their constituents. If they're so focused on raising money, how are they actually going to be focused on representing the people of the district?
And shrinking the... I feel like I've heard it's worse. People say they spend like towards like the last year as being a representative, like half their time is spent making phone calls to donors to fundraise and everything. That is like so much of the job is crazy to me. Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised by that. I mean, it takes a lot of money to win a race. Mm-hmm. But the Electoral College would be affected as well because, you know, like a state right now, like Wyoming, right? They have one representative. They have three Electoral College votes. Their population is like 500,000.
Yeah.
And you look at a state like California, who has way more electoral, you know, power because they have way more votes, but they're significantly underrepresented. California, Texas, all of these big states are way underrepresented, and states like Wyoming have a lot more sway into the presidential election because of that.
Mm-hmm. I do like the idea that if you have strong feelings about the Electoral College, of which many people do, that doing this kind of uncapping of the House and rebalancing things that way in a way goes towards addressing some of the grievances that people have about the Electoral College being very unrepresentative, because it does dilute a bit. I say dilute, but it brings back into balance the power of a lot of those smaller states that probably have a massively disproportionate say in the election because of how the Electoral College system works, which is, I for people that don't know, it's every state gets, I believe, two votes and then plus the number of districts they have. So if we uncap the House and people can have more districts, then arguably that's balanced out a bit better. Or not arguably, it would be balanced out a bit better.
Yeah, and the people, I think, and the key is always, it's about access and accountability and representation. Mm-hmm. Like a state like California, I would argue, you know, Republicans in the state of California completely are unrepresented. There's almost never Republicans in charge in California, and vice versa in Texas, although we're seeing a little shift in Texas right now. And both of those states, because if you shrink the districts, you'd get a more representative body, right? If you're talking about the Electoral College, by shrinking the districts and adding House seats and votes in the Electoral College, you're balancing it between the smaller states. You're making it more representative of the popular vote, which I know is an issue that a lot of people really care about. But you don't need a constitutional amendment to do this. This is way easier, right? Because uncapping the House is just simply writing a new apportionment bill and expanding the number of representatives in the legislative body.
Yeah. When you are pushing for this issue, what is like the best avenue of attack, I guess, in your mind? Like, how do you even begin to approach something like this? Are you trying to like raise awareness amongst people in states to get like referendums on it in states to support it, or to petition members of the House or Senate, or as part of a presidential campaign? Yeah.
So all of the above, but my main focus is creating a movement where people actually email their representative, right? This is, I've been told that if they get an email 80 to 100 per month, right, on the same issue, a representative will take it up. Uh-huh. Right. And I think the key is like, if you want self-government, you've got to speak up for it. Right. Like, we, the people, need to actually tell our representatives that this is important to us. So I want to create a movement where average everyday Americans take 5 minutes out of their day. You can go to our website, projectnocap.com, and you can actually email your representative directly from our site. Or you can go to your representative site and you can use their portal and you can email them. This will give you a clear concept of what our representatives are doing, which is not responding to you. Uh-huh. it'll probably take you 80 to 100 emails before you get an appropriate response. And when you do get that response, it probably will have nothing to do with your email that you sent in, but eventually they will listen to you. If enough of us speak up about this issue, they will have to take it up, because here's the thing. The 2030 census is the next time that we're supposed to apportion the House, right? It's supposed to happen every 10 years. We haven't done it for nearly 100 years now. 1929 will be the 100-year anniversary of the Permanent Apportionment Act. And this is something that's vital to American democracy, right? We need to speak up about it. We need to get the people in office and running for office right now to talk about and educate themselves about this issue. And the best way to do that is to just email your representative and be persistent. Just because you don't get a response doesn't mean you don't keep talking, because this is something that matters. It doesn't matter just for now, but it matters for your children and your children's future.
Mm-hmm. Are you aware of sorry, I my mind just got wiped. So many people in chat are typing, hold on, I have to ask this. You have like no cap merch or something, right? You must, right?
We do have no cap merch on okay. Our website. You can go to our website and purchase.
Just making sure. Sorry, I remember my question. When they passed the bill, was it in 1929 to cap the House? What was their rationale for it?
So it's like anything. You know, there's so many different points. What was happening at that period of time, because this started really from the 1890s up in through the 1920s, mm-hmm. and the population was exploding, right? Because of immigration. There was also World War I that was going on, where a whole bunch of people were overseas. So you had these population shifts that was really dramatically increasing the size of the House, but also shifting representative power all across the country. It was the 1920 census was the first census that recorded a population over 100 million, mm-hmm. and more people living in urban areas than rural areas. So you can imagine a lot of like people that were in the House were threatened with losing their jobs. So there was a big argument over, well, should we count all the people in the country or just citizens, right? Because if you go back to the Constitution, it's all persons, but it's all persons because of the slavery issue. We didn't want to put citizens in the Constitution for a couple different reasons, yeah. Some good, some bad, right? But like, we're living with the results of this. And then, you know, it was like, some people thought that the House was too unruly already. They thought there was already too many members in the House. So, you know, there's various different reasons why ultimately you couldn't get it passed. The Apportionment Act did not pass after the 1920 census, and they debated this for 10 years. And finally, they just gave up. They wrote the Permanent Apportionment Act, and here we sit today.
All right. Do you know if you must have. Do you know who Mr. Beat is?
I absolutely know who Mr. Beat is. Mr. Beat is actually on our board now.
Okay.
He joined us in February, and he's been a wonderful advocate for this niche reform issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like he pushes this so more than anybody else I've heard of besides you now. Yeah, I feel like he's a very big advocate of this uncapping the House thing. Would you be in favor of setting like a new apportionment to like 1,000 or 970 or whatever? Or do you want it to just be completely uncapped and then to just scale up as population grows?
So the organization's answer to that is we want to repeal the Permanent Apportionment Act and force Congress to do their job.
Okay.
My personal opinion is like we need to set some sort of representation ratio for the House to continue to be apportioned in the future.
Gotcha.
And I think somewhere around a 1-for-400,000 or a 1-for-500,000 ratio is pretty good. Sean Casten has a bill right now. He's a representative in Illinois, and he has a bill that would set about a 1-in-500,000 ratio, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember the numbers off the bat, but I think again, people talking about this is what's important, and understanding that it's about representation, not a set fixed arbitrary number.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that liberals or conservatives are generally more sympathetic to this, or is this just you don't really pay attention to the party here, and you're pretty apolitical when it comes to conversations?
No, I mean, it's almost impossible to be apolitical in politics. Everybody sure. lets you know right out of the gate what they believe in, which is great. But Democrats are typically on board with this quicker than conservatives are. Conservatives have this natural resistance to change, right? Mm-hmm. But once they hear it, they're on board with it too. They're like, wait, this is actually the way things are supposed to be. This is actually the most conservative reform that you can find. It's also the most progressive reform that you can find because it's a big change. And it's taking things back into an institutional structural way. So it blends the two really well. Our organization is right now is probably leans left versus right just because of the volunteers that have signed up. But mm-hmm. I imagine that's going to balance out over time.
Are you guys big enough yet that you have any like formal opposition? Like have there ever been like groups or congressmen that have kind of like come out and made snide remarks or spoken out explicitly against you guys, or do you think you're still kind of flying under the radar for you haven't picked up those types of haters yet?
Yeah, we're definitely flying under the radar. I've gotten representatives to try to explain to me why we don't need to uncap the House by like explaining all the things they do as a workaround for the issue.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody directly just, I mean, if you're arguing against this, you're arguing against representative democracy and you're living in America. So like, are you supporting one party rule or are you like actually believe in the system that you are sworn to uphold? So I really don't think there's a solid argument against this. There will be a solid argument for like maybe a limited raise as opposed to a larger raise. But that is going to come after 2030.
Sure. Okay. Well, damn, I feel like that's most of the basis. What else? Are there any other like thing, like pet, what would I say, like issues that kind of move hand in hand with this? Like I mentioned the gerrymander thing earlier, kind of the Electoral College. Are there any other big reforms or small reforms that you think kind of go hand in hand with this or any issues that you push alongside this one?
I don't push anything else. I am mm-hmm. singularly focused on this particular issue. There's lots of things that I think needs to be done. I think we need, I think we're basically due for a third founding, if you will. You know, like the second founding happened at the Civil War, fixed a lot of things that were mistakes that we made during the Constitution process. And I think, you know, just, you know, Jefferson didn't believe that the Constitution should last more than 30 years because he didn't want the dead ruling the living, right? But we have the amendment process. We have an ability to change the rules. And I think that every once in a while, you just need to kind of refresh. Technology changes, people changes, the country changes. We need to fix the problems in front of us. Particularly if I was in charge, I would work on a constitutional amendment for immigration. We need a process that everybody is okay with to let people into the country and make sure that they are safe, because illegal immigration hurts immigrants just as much as it hurts American citizens, right? Like, if this happened in the 1910s and 1920s, I think, again, immigration was a big part of why the House was capped originally. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing it right now. The question that the Trump administration tried to put on the census in the first time he was in office was a question of citizenship. Yeah. Are you a citizen or are you not a citizen, right? That's the same question that congressmen were posing during the apportionment debates. This isn't, you know, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure this out. When you talk about gerrymandering, I was just heard today, they try to use prisons to gerrymander because it's a concentrated population of people who can't vote, sure, right? So it doesn't matter. They want them in their district. Well, that's the same thing that happens with immigrants. You know, they bring in immigrants to their districts so they can secure their power in the House of Representatives. It doesn't mean that they actually want to take care of those people, because if they did, they would find a way to get them the right to vote, mm-hmm, to get them a right to representation. That's what our government was founded on. And everybody that's here should have that ability.
How long have you been pushing this issue? Like, how long has this been kind of like a project for you, I guess?
So I took up this issue. I ran in the Republican primary for Congress in 2022. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get very far. I was just kind of learning. And then I joined No Cap in 2023. And last year, I just basically, it's just me and another guy at the time. I was just learning what to do. Because like I said, I'm a small business owner. I'm a father of five. I didn't go to college. This isn't like something that I foresaw myself doing at any point in time. And I took the year last year to learn, educate myself on how to build an organization like that and like this. And this is kind of our first year really taking the plunge to like really make this a big issue. Our goal is to get this talked about in the 2026 midterms. Mm-hmm. Everybody running for Congress should have to talk about this issue. It is the most important issue out there.
Okay. I agree. I feel like there are a couple of, I hate even that you, I don't know why you're saying kind of like a niche issue. There are some things that I feel like are like should be more important, but they are kind of niche issues. Like, I feel like statehood for territories is a thing we don't talk about much, you know, especially concerning DC and Puerto Rico. I feel like it's kind of weird the kind of state, but not state status that these places have sometimes. I'm trying to think of anything else. Yeah, are there any other thoughts, feelings, ideas? Yeah.
What do you think our opposition is going to be? Right? Like, you've spoken to politicians and people out there before. Like, you kind of got a feel for this. Like, help me understand what I'm getting into. What do you think my biggest opposition is going to be going forward?
Whatever I think of, I think, unfortunately, you're absolutely correct that, like, whatever the opposition is, 85% is going to be just apathy. I think people don't really know how our government works. Not to knock you for running as a Republican, but I don't think that like Trump knows how the government works. I don't know if anybody really knows the structure of any of these things. So when you're trying to push for like a reform to the House, I think that people just aren't aware. Now, it might be that you could sell it more, I imagine, as a pet issue in different areas. You mentioned that conservatives in California, you know, probably don't feel very represented. They probably definitely don't after the recent gerrymander that California did in response to Texas's gerrymander. But like, I imagine you could sell that idea to them as a form of like, you know, you just got all of your seats taken from you. Wouldn't it be better to kind of protect against that? Or wouldn't you want to feel like you have representatives in Congress that are representing your issues and not just national level ones? You know, for blue states that are losing FEMA funding, I'm sure there are red districts in there that could be represented by representatives that probably wouldn't be very happy. It would make the federal government maybe a bit more responsive to the needs of people in individual districts in states, rather than right now it's just like the blob of conservative versus liberal. And like you said, you know, what was it? It was like access, accountability, and representation. I feel like it's kind of been lost in the House. It's more of kind of a game that you play with leadership structure and then a little bit of celebritydom and then some caucuses. And yeah, it's a little bit removed from its original purpose. But yeah, but unfortunately, like you said, I feel like it's just an apathetic thing. I don't think most people know how the Electoral College is structured or even how the House works. I don't know if you've realized this, but as soon as you start to get into heavy political spaces, it's, you can become very disconnected from a normal person's engagement with government very quickly. Like what is it, like 40% of people can't name like all three branches of government? You know, I'm sure very few people know what the Supreme Court does. Yesterday, we had a passionate debate between me and a political operative and then another friend who covers politics. His name is Guy. I'm really important. I don't know if you've ever heard of him as a streamer or YouTuber. But it was a passionate debate over like who should be the head of the DNC, like whether or not Ken Martin should step down. And it's like 95% of Democratic voters probably have no idea even what the DNC is, let alone who Ken Martin is. So, yeah, that apathy thing is so hard to push against when everybody is so cynical about government today.
Yeah, well, what I'd say to that is I was probably one of those people 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I couldn't have explained how our government worked. I might have been able to pick out the three branches of government, maybe, but you know, but it's not something that I paid attention to. And I like to tell people, like, everybody is smart, right? Like, everybody is a genius in the things that they know, mm-hmm. and they're kind of an idiot in the things that they don't know, right? And we know the things that are important to us that we put time in. And what I try to tell people is, like, I learned it and so can you, right? And this is important for all the things that you find important, right? Your house, your land, your family, your job, your passions, your travel, whatever you care about, it's secured by this system of government that allows you safety and freedom to do the things that you want to do. So like, maybe you don't know it right now, and that's okay. Like, I didn't know it either, but you can know it. It just takes a little bit of time. You know, like, we have literally a world of information at our fingertips at all time. And if you can't find it on the internet, you can find it in books. If you can't find it in books, you can find it, you know, some crazy guy on the side of the street talking about uncapping the house, right? Like, there's people out there to help you. And this is something that we can all do. We can get past that apathy thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking... Yeah, there's different political strategies you could use to try to push this, but yeah, at the end of the day, it's a salience issue. So I guess it comes down to whether or not you can get into people's social media feeds and get them caring about this particular issue. The biggest failure is, I think we've talked for 36 minutes and I haven't heard you explain how this is going to solve Israel-Palestine yet. So maybe that's the thing you guys need to work on more to get voters to care about it a lot. So yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, let's put it this way. Whatever you think about Israel and Palestine, your voice will be heard by your representative. You can actually get a meeting with them.
Sure.
You don't have to go out in the street and yell and scream. You can actually articulate your points. And maybe whatever it is that you feel will actually be represented in the government at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't disagree. Yeah, any other thoughts or feelings or opinions?
I mean...
We can talk we got at least 20 more minutes if you want to chat about it, whatever. Yeah. I'm not trying to kick you out or anything. Yeah, I just legitimately can't think of anything. This is one of those issues where I generally argue with people. That's usually what I do. But sometimes there are things where I feel like there are reforms that are, I don't want to say common sense, but I'm like, if you address all the facts, I feel like we should probably do this. And I don't really know what the opposition to it would be other than low levels of salience or very, very partisan pushback, unfortunately. I feel like this is one of those issues. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, people that work for the executive branch aren't going to like this, right? Because the legislative branch is supposed to provide oversight over the executive branch. And if we look at what the Trump administration did this go around, is they created DOGE, right? They're saying, hey, we're wasting all this money. All of these things are bad. And we're going to hire these five people to clear it out in this AI program. It hasn't really worked, right? Because it takes a lot of people to actually oversight the government and to know these programs, to understand their purpose, to make sure that things are going smoothly. And right now they're just outmanned. So the executive branch kind of gets to do whatever they want, you know, and the legislative branch really has no way to stop them. It becomes a partisan fight as opposed to an issue of government. And so, you know, I would imagine anybody running for president is probably going to be against it unless they want to be a legend, mm-hmm. right? Like, if you want to be a legend, this is an issue that you take up. I was just, before we came on, I was sitting there, I was watching, you know, Netflix and Prime Video. They have these great documentaries on like Washington and Grant and Lincoln. And, you know, part of the reason that they are remembered the way that they are is not just because of their personal temperament and the decisions that they made and the leadership that they brought the country. It was timing, right? We needed them at the moment that they were there and they stepped up in the moment. This is a moment that we really need a great leader. You know, I look, I find myself on the right side, right? I don't participate in, you know, typical partisan politics. And I look and I say, right now on the right, you've got J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio. I don't think I trust J.D. Vance more than I can throw him, which I got a new hip last year, so I probably can't throw him very far.
Okay.
Marco Rubio, you know, he's now working for the guy that I didn't vote for, but he always speaks very optimistically about America. You know, he's got a great American story. This is an issue that if he took up, he'd probably be remembered, and he could probably win the next election if he took this issue up and ran on it. And not only that, but he could lead the country through a very turbulent time and be able to, you know, be remembered as one of the greats. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the aisle, I think of somebody like Josh Shapiro. I remember that speech that he gave in I think it was Philadelphia last year. It was just electric. You know, what's really important in leadership sometimes is just being able to articulate a point, but also an emotion.
Yeah.
And he has that ability. And again, if these people want to win and they want to be remembered, this is the issue that they would take up.
Yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword. I think Trump does a lot of things because he's hoping that he'll be remembered for them. I think he just picks the wrong issues. But yeah, I definitely know what you mean in that. It just comes down to, yeah, I guess raising the salience to the average American so that the elected leader feels like it's something they would be remembered for. It would be a big change, though, for sure.
But that's what a leader's supposed to do, right? Like you're saying, like, we've got to raise the issue up so they pay attention to us. Why are our leaders not talking about this? This is the biggest problem that I have, is I am an average citizen with five kids who working two full-time jobs to get the thing that I'm guaranteed a right to get based on the Constitution. My taxes pay their dollars and they're not talking about this. This is a big problem. If you're running for congressman, Senate, or the presidency, this is your number one issue. And if it's not your number one issue, what are you doing? Sorry.
There, I'm a little passionate about this sometimes. I understand what you're saying 100%. There's when it comes to like what I do on YouTube or streaming or whatever, and it comes to politics or building stuff over here, and I think it works the same way in the real world too. It's interesting. You have this like power that you can build up. And the funny thing is it feels like with power or influence that you build up, you can build it up to a certain level. And the more power that you have, the more power you're able to acquire. And some people play that game forever, which I think is really disappointing, because in my mind, what you're doing is you're building up these kind of like reservoirs of power so that ideally at some points in time, you can cash in on that power to make some sort of change. So if I build my power up to, you know, 55, at some point, I'm going to trade in 5 to stand against the wind and to say, this is what we should do. And this might cost me some popularity whatever else, but I've built up so much that I can do this now. But I don't know if it's social media algorithms or, you know, if it's too much lead in the water or whatever. I don't know what it is. But now it feels like a lot of people are very much just, this is where the political winds are blowing and I have no choice but to be a sail in the wind. And there are so many times where, yeah, I feel that frustration where it's like, you know, you talk to somebody, and especially, my God, especially in the YouTube world, but it's absolutely true in politics as well now, where it's like, listen, like, the time is now and it's calling for great leadership. And all you guys are doing is saying, well, this is the way the world is. So this is the direction that I'm headed. And it's like, well, it could be different if you took a stand against it and were at least the first person to take a stand against it. And then maybe others would follow. Like, that is the point of great leadership, right? Is, you know, you're splitting the river here and you're saying we're going to flow in a different direction. We're not just going to follow the path as it is right now. And it's very, very, very hard to get people to do that now, because there's like this oppressive, crushing weight on anybody that tries to go against these tidal forces, because they're so heavily driven by and mediated by these like online algorithms and social media apps and everything else too. I do agree with you, though, that it's very frustrating that it's like, who's going to be the leader that is going to step up and do, you know, what needs to be done, even if it's not super popular right now, you know?
Right. And I think to your point of what you were talking about Trump, that's how he thinks of himself. He thinks that he is doing that. He's just not doing the right things. You're 100%. Yeah. This is the right thing. Like, if you're like, you know, he considers himself like an Andrew Jackson, people person, right? But he's not doing anything that gives actual people power. If you want to give actual people power, you expand the house, right? Like, that's how you give people power. Mm-hmm. And like the way you were describing power there, it sounds very similar to almost what Lincoln did, you know, leading up to the Civil War. and then becoming president in the Civil War, he very much did exactly what you said. He built these reservoirs of power. And then when it came time, he did the hard thing, right? Like he signed the, you know, he wrote the Emancipation Proclamation. He led the Union through the Civil War. Uh-huh. You know, he did the really hard things, similar to Washington. And that's the type of person we need right now. And I think that's why I and a lot of other Americans are so frustrated, is because it just doesn't seem to be anybody who has that type of courage out there.
Yeah. I feel like if it was possible, unfortunately, this starts to get very, very, very partisan. Well, actually, I'm sorry, this is 100% partisan. But like, if DC and Puerto Rico became a state, then I feel like this conversation very easily and naturally is paired with that. Because if they did become a state, or if they both became states, you would have to have some kind of, I don't imagine you would just cram even more representatives into that 435. And then as part of that conversation, having an uncapping thing, I think would be good. I do feel like if this was raised to a high level of salience, it would be kind of hard to argue against it. Like how, like you said, how are you going to argue against having more representative districts? How are you going to argue against making it theoretically harder to gerrymander? How are you going to argue against people, you know, having greater representation of the House? I do feel like it's hard to put up arguments on the other side. You just rely right now on nobody really talking about it. You know?
Yeah. And the only other thing that they'll say is, well, it's, you're going to have to pay all those people, so it's going to cost you money. And my argument to that is, okay, yeah, but now you have more people to provide oversight over the executive branch where all the money gets wasted.
Sure.
Right. So like now you can actually hold that branch to account and you can, you know.
But it's also, we're talking, this is like, my guess would be, this is like a drop in the bucket. Maybe in the millions of dollars for how, like, salaries and everything else. This is very, very small compared to the government budget. So, yeah.
I think on our website, our FAQ document, we have the numbers. I don't have them off the top of my head, but it is a very small fraction of money compared to what we actually spend. And you know, you think about it like this. You're building a business. You're building a movement. You're, whatever you're doing, you invest in people, mm-hmm. right? Like, you never really invest in the thing. You're investing in the person. And this is an investment in the American people.
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% agree. Did you, or I'm just curious, I guess from a semi-personal level, did you change your mind on this, or did Mr. Beat change his mind on like any part of this when you guys connected and started chatting about it?
So Mr. Beat met Walter, who founded No Cap, about a year ago now. Mm-hmm. They spoke together at the Dole Institute, and Walter was speaking about this issue. And I think it was, I don't know if he had just heard about it or that was the first time he heard about it, but it was the time that he started considering it. And he was like, you know, this is actually, this might be the thing we need to do. And then he thought about it for a few months and he came on our representation station. It's a live stream we do on Monday nights. And we talked about it during the episode. And afterwards he like messaged us and he's like, yeah, I think this is what I'm going to devote my time to. And then he joined our board in there. So, you know, I don't think it took a lot of convincing. It just was like, it's kind of like, I tell people, like, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Like, once you understand this issue, you can't go away from it. You can't let it go. I have hundreds of people in my community where I live who know very little about politics, who are not concerned about politics at all, that very much care about this issue simply because I explained it to them. And now they can't not see it, right? Like that's the thing.
On that point, there are so many low salience issues that I feel are unfortunately exactly like that. Where I'm like, if anybody realized how stupid this particular thing was, I have a hard time believing that people would be okay with it. This is peripherally related. I don't know how you feel about it or whatever, but like, I don't know why Maine and Nebraska are the only states that split their electoral vote. I don't understand that. I've never understood that. I feel like that's kind of goofy. Like if you have 100 districts and or it, like if you've got 100 million people living in a state and 49 million people vote one way and 51 million people vote the other way, that state gives all of its electoral votes to one candidate. That just seems so unbelievably goofy to me. And yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say there are reasons for that and it would take me some time to explain that. Mm-hmm. But I guess the most simplistic reason for that is somebody was fighting over power at some point in time, right?
Sure.
And they write rules to get their side to win. It's very similar to what we're seeing now. You know, there's a push out there for multi-member districts, right? We had multi-member districts in the United States for some time, and they can be manipulated too, or maybe they work better, but like, it's a big change, right? And I think everybody sees these reforms as a way to like edge their interest or their party's side. But I think you know, if we're doing, if we're making change for that reason, we're probably not going down the right path. I think the right path is the change that empowers everyone, not necessarily equally, because nothing's going to come out equal, but it empowers everyone regardless, right? It isn't going to help one side or the other. Or I think the biggest issue is it's never really between red or blue. It's between wealthy and not wealthy, right? People that have a lot of money and can get access and accountability to their representatives and people who don't, right? And those people are on both sides of the aisle. And they're the ones typically that don't want to make big changes, because big changes means new opportunities for other people, which means maybe they don't keep their position of power. Maybe they have to work harder for it. There's lots of different things that can happen in that time period.
Yeah, you said something at the beginning of this that I think is a little bit important to focus on. You mentioned about how this would be like better for democracy in a way, and you talked about voting and representation. I think that Americans especially, I don't know why, maybe just we don't take enough civics classes. I think we learn too many concepts, and then those concepts become boiled down to very simplistic rules that people think the rule is the concept. Like, there's an example I use when it comes to the First Amendment and freedom of speech, right? Like, let's say you have 10 people in a room who are free to say whatever they want, and they for 1 hour, and they all are incredibly well-trained singers, and they just scream for an hour. And then in the next room, you have 9 people and one guy with a gun, and he goes down the line for each person. Each of you can speak for 6 minutes, okay? And then boom, 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 boom. Not boom, boom, like he shoots somebody. Like, you know, he enforces that rule, you know? Arguably, the first room has way more, quote-unquote, freedom. But like the second room is probably having a better like freedom of speech, because people can actually be heard. And there are so many rules that we have in our current system where it's like democracy is not just the idea that everybody goes and votes. It's the idea, like what we're trying to proxy is how well is the average desire of a person represented in some form at the appropriate level of governance. In some ways, that might come down to a referendum where every single citizen in the state votes on a particular thing. But most of the time, it doesn't. It's on a representative of some sort who is embodying the will, ideally, of the constituents beneath him, and then who's carrying that will forward into the legislature, and then ideally that, you know, cashes out into some form of legislation or not legislation. And I mean, like you said, like the reality is 400,000 people on the aggregate can be represented better than by one person than 800,000 people can be represented by one person. And trying to get people to divorce themselves so heavily sometimes from this idea of, you know, what is democracy? Is it just like one person, one vote, or whatever? You know, this is the rule and this is how it goes. Like, well, no, it's like, how do you get the average will of like the average voter to be represented in some way, size, shape, or form? And in that sense, I feel like this is just obviously, especially in the half of our parliament, in the half of our legislative body that's supposed to be representative. It's called the House of Representatives, right? Like, that's the job of this place, you know? You want to talk about land or states, that's what the Senate is for. But in the House of Representatives, it should represent the average voter, you know, numerically more than the Senate does, obviously, yeah? And more than it does now, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I think it has a lot to do both with, you know, kind of your point on, you know, a leader not taking this issue up because it hasn't reached that point of saliency is like, it's a relationship, right? And because the structure that brings the people and the representative together into a relationship is broken, that relationship's broken. And it's hard to have trust, right? It's hard to understand these things, both for the leader and the people. Like I said, most of the voters out there, they're like, I don't trust this. I don't trust these people. I bet you the leaders don't trust themselves and what to do. They're afraid of losing their job. They don't have courage because they figure if they go out and they do the thing that they believe is right, that people won't back them. They need their donors. They need the party apparatus. They need all these things. I think of this, I'm probably going to butcher this, but there's a story about Winston Churchill during World War II. I believe it was right before D-Day, and he was really struggling with like pulling the trigger. He knew that this was going to create a lot of casualties. It was going to be really difficult for his country to persevere through this. And he left his office building and he went down into the subway. I can't remember what they call it in England. And he basically asked 5 people on the subway car. He told them what they were planning, and they were all like, "Do it. We've got your back." Right. And it was that type of like that reassurance, that relationship with the average person that they're going to understand this and support you, even though it might sound crazy or it might be really difficult. That's what gives leaders courage. And because the structure's broken and, you know, we can't find a way to communicate or build that relationship back is the problem. And that's why we have to raise that salience. And we need leaders to come down to us as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, sometimes you have, like, voters might not care about an issue right now, but it can also be, like you said, it's a feedback loop. It could be on you to make them care about it, raise it to a level of salience, and then maybe they will, you know? Have you ever communicated this to, I feel like of all the congressmen I know that like to take up issues like this, have you ever had an audience with Ro Khanna?
I have not. I want to, mm-hmm. I have been trying, so.
I feel like he's the kind of guy who would, yeah, I feel like if you poke Mr. Beat and get him on that, I feel like he's got to have a connection there somewhere. But I feel like he's the type of person who's especially interested in more progressive versions or visions, I guess, of government. I don't mean progressive in like the far left way, but like in a, what are kind of like big structural changes that we can make sometimes. I feel like he's one of those people that's kind of on board with that, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I follow him on X, and he seems like the type of person who's not afraid to do difficult things, too.
For sure.
And that's the type of person that we need. So if you're listening, Ro, I'm totally open to having a conversation with you. Yeah. I'll come visit you in Washington.
All right. Well, hopefully that happens. Yeah, any other thoughts, ideas? You said your website was...
So if you're interested, you can go to our website. It's www.projectnocap.com. On our website, there's just a few things that you can do. The first thing you can do is email your representative directly from our site. The second thing you can do is you can sign our declaration for representation to let your congressman know that this is an issue that you feel passionately about. And you can sign up to volunteer. As we've talked about here, this is an issue that we need to raise to the people that are representing us to make them take it seriously. We're building a grassroots network to make sure that happens, and we'd love to have you on our team.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. Any other thoughts, ideas? Anything else you want to go over? Or
No. So I just thank you for having me. I really appreciate this. This has been a wonderful conversation. Yeah. Hopefully your listeners enjoyed it.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, hey, thanks a lot for chatting with me about it. It has come up a few more times. I'll probably keep bringing it up in conversations. And hopefully you guys make some headway with some congressmen or other larger figures that want to chat about it as well. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Have a good
one. Remember to hit that like and subscribe. And don't forget the notification bell so that my videos show up right in your feed.